Talk about the onset of the Cold War and the Korean War. Now, one thing, the Cold War, as you know, just refers to the general conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union and the other communist nations after World War II. It wasn't a real shooting war. There was no shooting war between the United States and Russia during that period. So it wasn't really a war. And the Korean War certainly was a war that involved a lot of fighting, but it wasn't officially a war either, because as we'll be seeing later in the lecture, war was never declared by Congress. So the correct name for it is really the Korean conflict. I didn't observe that here. So to say one thing odd about this lecture on America's wars is that neither the Cold War nor the Korean War was a war in the strictest sense, but nevertheless, they're certainly very important and worth discussing. And I remember I said in the last lecture that we were talking then about origins of World War II, and I said you can't understand World War II, the origins of World War II, without considering World War I. Well, in a similar way, we can't understand the Cold War without understanding World War II. And in particular, we have to understand one basic fact about World War II. In World War II, there were a lot of nations that were fighting. The United States was involved, France, Britain, also Japan, China, all sorts of countries were fighting. But there was one part of World War II that was much more important than any of the other parts. And that was the conflict between Germany and Russia that started when Germany invaded Russia on June 22, 1941. This was all-out unconditional war. And I just want to illustrate how the scope of that conflict is compared to other parts of the war. You consider the famous D-Day invasion. This is when the United States went into France, landed in France on D-Day. Normandy beat June 6, 1944, and then that was the beginning of the invasion of Germany that led to the German defeat. So in the 6 weeks after D-Day, June 6, 1944, the German casualties, which would be the dead and wounded soldiers, were 140,000. Now, during the single week, June 22nd to June 29th, 1944, that's roughly comparable. It's just 1 week in the same year and same month. In that 1 week, in the single Vitebsk sector, the Bielorussian front, Vitebsk is a city in what was sometimes Bielorussia, but sometimes called White Russia. It's now the area is called Belarus. So Vitebsk is the important city. So in this single sector, in this city, the German casualties were 480,000. So it's several times as large as in all the D-Day casualties. So you can see the vast difference. I said several times as large. You do the math if you want to know exactly how much, because I can't. So you can do that. Okay, so as I say, when Germany invaded Russia, it was going to be all-out war. So if one side won the war, either the Germans or the Russians, if whichever side won the war would be in a very good position to dominate Central and Eastern Europe, because these two were by far the most important powers, and they're struggling with each other. So whichever one wins, if there is a winner, that one is going to dominate Central and Eastern Europe. Now, of course, it didn't have to be. There was a winner. They could have fought to a stalemate. But just if one side did score a decisive victory, then they'd be in a very good position to dominate that part of the continent. Now, when Roosevelt allied with Russia, remember, what was he saying? He was saying he realized most of the American people were opposed to entering World War II. They said, look what had happened in World War I. This had been a big mistake. We don't want to get involved in these European conflicts again. But Roosevelt said, no, he didn't say this explicitly to the people. This is what the way he was thinking. He said, no, the Nazis are really a menace to America. We've got to get in and fight them. We've got to defeat the Germans under Hitler. And to do that, we're going to ally with Russia. So this is why he, what I was trying to explain last week, I was agreeing with those historians that the way he got us into the war was through the back door. He provoked a Japanese attack, that we knew that would be a good way of getting into the war. He thought we had to get into the war against the Nazis. So when he did that, he was really choosing Russian dominance of Central and Eastern Europe, because Germany against Russia, whichever one wins, if one does win, is going to be able to dominate Central and Eastern Europe. And Roosevelt was saying, well, we've got to go in and support the Russians. So he's in effect saying, I'm willing to accept Russian dominance of Central and Eastern Europe. Now, you might think, somebody might say, well, you know, the Soviet dictatorship under Stalin is, of course, a terrible thing, but, you know, Hitler is really even worse or more of a menace to us, so we have to stop him first. And well, we do have to ally with the Russians temporarily, but that's just because we need them to battle the Nazis. But it doesn't mean we like the Russians. And perhaps Churchill had this sort of attitude. I'll be going into that a little later. But Roosevelt didn't. Roosevelt did not have the view Russia is a totalitarian dictatorship, really on the same level as the Nazis. Maybe we have to ally with them now, but they're really very, Stalin's a very bad person. We don't really want to ally with him, but we just have no choice. And that's not the way he felt about the Stalin and the communists. But he actually had a very high opinion of Stalin. He thought Stalin was a great leader. And he also had a very high opinion of himself. FDR thought, well, if he could just get together with Stalin, he could influence him through his personal charm. And then Stalin would be able to see what a good person Roosevelt was, and then they'd be able to cooperate and build the post-war world after they defeated the Nazis. Now, according to William Bullitt was a former American ambassador to Moscow, FDR told him, this is a quotation from Bullitt, we don't have an original document where Roosevelt said this directly, but this is what Bullitt, who's the ambassador, said that Roosevelt had said to him. He said, I think if I can give him, meaning Stalin, I think if I give him everything I possibly can and ask nothing from him in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of peace and democracy. So this is Roosevelt's attitude. Now, Bullitt, incidentally, is a very curious character. He wrote a book together with Freud. He actually wrote most of the book. He wrote a book, a very interesting book on Woodrow Wilson with Sigmund Freud. And it's very anti very much worth reading. He's very critical of Woodrow Wilson. So many of the people who normally, historians who normally like Freud, were a bit upset when this came out because they said they liked Wilson too. So here you have Freud, he's writing this book attacking Wilson. So they dismiss it, say, oh, well, this is really Bullitt who's written the book. It's not really Freud's stuff. But actually, I think it's very much worth reading. But he was a very colorful character, William Bullitt. If you ever want to look him up, you find it, I think, very interesting. So, but this is what he said, what Bullitt said, showed what FDR's attitude toward Stalin was. Now, in contrast to his very favorable view of Stalin, you're saying, well, we can cooperate with Stalin, he's really a nice guy. FDR was hostile to the British Empire. He wanted the British colonies to become independent. Remember, the British Empire was the greatest empire in the world. India was part of the British Empire, but now Pakistan was part of the British Empire. The British Empire was all over the world. And Roosevelt said the British Empire should really come to an end. And one reason for this was that American business interests wanted to supplant the British in the British-controlled area. So Roosevelt and some of the people in the State Department were thinking, well, the British really need us. We're giving them all this aid, lend, lease aid. So after the war, we'll be able to supplant the British. We'll take over some of these areas that they've colonized. They won't be able to hold them away from American business interests. According to one school of interpretation, the American business was interested in breaking down any barriers to overseas expansion on the part of businesses. So this was one reason that there was this hostility to the British Empire. So, given this attitude, FDR did not regard himself as allied with Churchill, the British Prime Minister, against Stalin. So say you have the three major powers, America, Britain, and Russia, who were on the Allied side. France was under the Free French, and de Gaulle were also in there, but in China, but they weren't as significant. But Roosevelt did not have the attitude, well, British and Americans are democracies, and so we have to stand together against the Russian dictatorship. He did not regard himself as allied with Churchill against Stalin. He was quite favorable to Stalin. Now, one thing, if you say with Stalin, we have to consider, well, what was the Russian policy during the war? What, of course, they wanted to defeat the Germans, but what were the indications of what they wanted to do after the war if they were successful, if the war against Hitler was successful? Well, remember, World War II began after Britain and France declared war on Germany. The Germans invaded Poland September 1st, 1939. Remember, the Germans had said to the Poles, we want the return of the city of Danzig, which was under League of Nations High Commissioner. Foreign relations were really controlled by Poland. They said to the Poles, we want you to agree that Danzig should come back to Germany. We also want a motor road across the so-called Polish corridor so that we can have easy access to East Prussia. The Polish corridor was a band of Polish territory that separated East Prussia from the rest of Germany. So the Germans said, well, we want to be connected with this, and if you give us this, we then will guarantee everything else in Poland, will get along with you, we'll all be great friends. So the Poles didn't want to didn't want to accept this, and they wouldn't negotiate with Hitler over this, so he invaded September 1st, 1939. Now, the British, in March 1939, guaranteed the borders of Poland. They said to the Poles, all right, if you go ahead and resist the Germans, if you don't accept their demand, we'll back you up, and if the Germans attack you, we'll come to your defense, and we'll guarantee that you get your same borders that you had. So the German attack on Poland was the central reason that the British got involved. That was why they declared war September 3rd. The French also declared war September 3rd, and the British pushed them into it. The French foreign minister, was named Georges Bonnet, really wasn't very enthusiastic about getting into the war, but the British had pushed them in. So what the whole occasion for the war was on the British and French side was the Germans had invaded Poland. So you would think, well, the Polish boundaries are then an extremely important war aim for the British. But when Russia invaded Poland from the east on September 17th, it became clear the British guarantee didn't apply against Russia. But there were some people who said in Britain, well, we guaranteed the Polish border, so why don't we declare war on Russia too? But then it turned out they hadn't guaranteed Poland against Russian attack, just against the German attack. The Russians were really sort of a kind of an odd situation. We're saying we're going to war to defend the boundaries of Poland, but just against one country, namely Germany. So when the Russians invaded, they followed a very brutal occupation policy. They took over about 52% of Poland, and then When they were coming in, of course, the Polish army didn't welcome with open arms. They resisted, but they were easily defeated. So the Polish army who resisted weren't given the status as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention. The Russians hadn't signed the Geneva Convention, and they didn't give the Polish army the normal rights that the captured soldiers of an enemy would have. They're supposed to be treated well. There are all sorts of international regulations about what you could do to captured prisoners that are regularly violated today, but you're supposed to follow these. And in fact, about 22,000 Polish officers, police, and intellectuals were murdered near the Katyn Forest in 1941. They were just taken out, and I think shot in the back of the head, and all killed and just dumped in a mass grave. I think somebody said, you mean enemy combatants? I think that was the way they handled it. They said, these people aren't regular soldiers that were recognized. In fact, Russia had never signed the Geneva Convention at all. Furthermore, about 1,200,000 people from Poland, just the small p rather capital, were deported. These were various groups, Poles, others, were just deported. Many of them were sent to the Gulag. They were just shipped out of the country. And see, this is the nation that the U.S. has allied with, that they're doing all these horrible things. Now, when the Germans gained control of the Katyn area in 1943, remember the war began June 22, 1941 between Germany and Russia. The Katyn massacre had taken place right after the Russians had moved into Poland, but in 1943, the Germans gained control of this area, and they discovered these mass graves, and they conducted an investigation to blame the Russians. They brought in experts, forensic pathologists from various countries in Europe who had them conduct an investigation, and they were able to determine when the massacre took place, and they were able to show that when the massacre had taken place, this territory was under Russian control. So that was one of the main arguments that the Russians had done it. So this created quite a sensation when this report was published. I mean, people normally wouldn't, not on the German side, wouldn't believe Nazi propaganda, but they had a lot of evidence for what they were saying in this case. And Dr. Goebbels, who's a Nazi minister of propaganda, knew that when this report was issued, it would create a lot of trouble among the Allies. And the Polish government in exile asked the Russians what's going on. They said, did you do this? The Germans are saying you're guilty. Well, what happened to these officers? What do you know about this? So the Russians professed to be insulted that the Polish government exile were in London had asked them about this. So they broke off relations with the Polish government exile. And they were really looking for an excuse to do that anyway, because Russia wanted a communist government in post-war Poland. The London government was not a communist government. It was more based on the political parties in Poland that had been present in 1939. There was a Peasants' Party that was very influential in the Polish government's exile. But they were an anti-communist group, largely, and the Russians really didn't want to recognize them. So when the Polish government said, well, we want to know what's going on, what's the story of the Kansas City massacre, the Russians broke off relations with them. Now, considering the military situation, there was very little America could have done about this. I mean, once the Russians had moved into Poland, the Americans couldn't very well tell them, you've got to get out, especially because we're allied with them. But Roosevelt went much further than just saying, well, you know, this is the military necessity of the situation, so while you're there, you really can't do anything about it. He, at the famous Yalta Conference, Yalta is in the Crimea, Roosevelt and Churchill had gone to see Stalin in February 1945, and Roosevelt signed this Yalta Agreement, recognizing the communist-backed provisional government as the government of Poland. And there was an unenforceable promise that other democratic elements would be included in the Polish government. But Roosevelt was really saying, okay, the Russians, you know, you may have done all these terrible massacres, but we're still recognizing that your group is the legitimate government of Poland. Now, also in the Yalta Agreement, the Russians had incorporated parts of eastern Poland into Russia. So it wasn't just they wanted a communist government in Poland. They'd taken over certain parts of Poland and put them in Russia. For example, the city, famous city of Lemberg, you know, the city that Ludwig von Mises was born, had become, in between the wars, it became the Polish city of Lvov, L-V-O-F. So this now was incorporated into, this city was now part of the Ukraine when the Russians took it over. Ukraine was one of the, at that time, was an independent country, it was part of Russia. By the Russian Republic, and it became the city of Lviv. Those parts of East Poland were now part of Russia. And Poland was supposed to get compensation from that. They'd be taken over, parts of Poland were now in Russia. So parts of Germany would then be put into Poland as compensation. Now, FDR was quite willing to accept that, but he was concerned about, but there were a lot of Polish voters in the U.S., so he said, well, we have to have something here. He said, we're concerned about the democracy, so we can say something about other democratic elements that have to be included. But he really didn't oppose the Russians. He sort of said, he pretty much said, well, okay, you've taken over Poland, this is fine with me. Now, as I mentioned before, the U.S. decision to support Russia over Germany ensured that Russia's position in Europe would be strengthened after the war, because that, remember, Germany and Russia are the largest powers in that part of the Europe. So whichever one wins, if one does win, that's going to be the dominant position. But that still doesn't say about how much the dominance, what they're going to be, how dominant would whichever the Russians be if they were the victorious power. Now, when Roosevelt insisted at the Casablanca Conference, which was in Morocco, January 1943, he insisted on unconditional surrender of Germany. He said, we're not going to negotiate any kind of deal with the Germans where they said we'll surrender on such and such terms. The Germans have to surrender unconditionally. So that ensured the Germans would just keep fighting, and the more the Germans kept fighting, then the greater the Russian gains would be. So unconditional surrender ensured really the Russian dominance of Central and Eastern Europe, because it meant there wouldn't be any negotiated settlement where the Russians would be kept back, at least in part. Unconditional surrender really made sure that the Russians were going to be in a dominant position. Now, how did Winston Churchill, who was the British Prime Minister, react to all this? Well, Churchill had been a long-time anti-communist. Right after the Bolshevik Revolution, November 1917, he called for military intervention against the Bolsheviks. He said that Bolshevism should have been strangled in its cradle. So he wasn't someone who was sympathetic to Stalin the way Roosevelt was. And he thought that Roosevelt wasn't taking enough account of Russian ambitions. He thought, well, it's very important to win the war against Germany. We should be concerned what the post-war position should be also. And he thought that FDR was very naive about Stalin and communism. FDR would say, well, I can get along with Stalin. He seems like a nice guy. Churchill thought this was a very naive view. However, we shouldn't, as some people do, some people paint a complete contrast between Churchill was kind of a wise anti-communist and Roosevelt was communist dupe. But we shouldn't exaggerate the differences. There were certainly differences between them, but we shouldn't exaggerate them. Churchill's opinion of Stalin went up in the war, so he wasn't going to the lengths Roosevelt was, but he thought maybe Stalin had changed, maybe Stalin had become more of a Russian nationalist, so we don't have to worry about international communism anymore. So his opinion of Stalin went up, and he didn't oppose unconditional surrender, which, you remember, I suggested was really ensuring Russian dominance in Eastern and Central Europe, because it meant the Germans would keep fighting as long as they could. So Churchill did not, contrary to what some people think, Churchill really didn't oppose that. But he did oppose plans for a second front in France, which Stalin won. Remember, there's this tremendous conflict between Russia and Germany. So what Stalin won, he said, well, the Americans and British should invade Western Europe just as they did in 1944. He wanted them to do that much earlier, because if they did that, that would relieve pressure on the Russian front. And then they didn't, because they said the Americans and British aren't ready to do that. They're not strong enough to do that. So Churchill was against the second front, which Stalin wanted. And he was also concerned about which armies would get to Germany first. The Soviets were very anxious that they would get to Berlin ahead of the British and Americans. And the Americans weren't really concerned about that very much, but Churchill was, and he favored an invasion strategy that would get to some of these important areas before the Russians. So he had in mind, much more than Roosevelt did, some of the post-war situation. However, again, Churchill was willing to go along with a lot of Russian control of Eastern Central Europe. So, as I say, we shouldn't contrast him altogether with Roosevelt. Because, for example, at the Tehran Conference in November, December 1943, Churchill accepted a dominant role for Russia in Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Baltic states, Romania. Remember, in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania, the Russians had simply taken over those countries. They were independent countries between World War I and World War II. The Russians, very small countries, the Russians simply absorbed them. And this was during the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, when there was a non-aggression pact between Germany and Russia. The Russians simply incorporated those states in the Soviet Union. And at the Tehran Conference, Churchill said, okay, we're not going to make you change that. You can have these states. So even Churchill, who didn't go as far as Roosevelt, was willing to go along with a great deal of increase in Russian control and influence in Central and Eastern Europe. Now, at the end of World War II, American policymakers faced an important decision. As I've tried to say probably too many times, that if the Russian victory in World War II meant that Russian power had really gone up in Central and Eastern Europe. So the question then confronting American policymakers, well, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to react to this? And there are basically three options available that I want to talk about now and go over all the three options. The first is non-intervention, containment, and rollback. So those were the three options. And I want to explain what each of them involved. Now, the old right, I'm sure you're familiar with this term. This is a term that Murray Rothbard liked to use a lot. For example, John T. Flynn, remember I gave you a reading from him last week. The old right thought the U.S. should go back to its traditional policy of non-involvement in Europe. Remember, our traditional policy said from the Washington Farewell Address that America should not become involved in European power politics. And we deviated from it under Woodrow Wilson, who got us into World War I. And of course, we've just been involved in a big war in Europe. So the old right said, well, now we've defeated the Germans, so we don't have to. We can go back to our position of non-involvement. If you say, well, what about the Russians? What about, you know, they're now in Eastern and Central Europe? Of course, Flynn didn't like that. He was a fervent anti-communist. But he said Russia really isn't in a position to threaten America militarily. Remember, America was economically and militarily the strongest nation on earth. Remember, the Russians had had this exhausting struggle with Germany. With Germany, they were in a very weak position. They lost millions and millions of people. And besides, if they wanted to attack us, they'd have to cross the Atlantic Ocean, which is no small matter. So we don't really have to worry about any military threat from the Russians, so we should go back to our policy of non-involvement in European affairs. Now, Flynn, of course, was a very important writer, but he didn't have any political position. And there were a few political leaders who supported a basically non-interventionist position. For example, Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, who was the son of President William Howard Taft. He was basically non-interventionist. Also, former President Herbert Hoover. So they said, basically, we shouldn't start some kind of big struggle with Russia. We should return to our non-interventionist policy. Now, it's interesting, the non-interventionist people said we shouldn't get involved in European power politics were sometimes not as opposed to intervention in Asia. They tended to think, well, maybe America does have, it's all right to get involved in Asia, although sometimes there were people who didn't want to get involved there either. But you can't always assume if somebody's against intervention in Europe that they want to be against, they'd be against intervention in Asia as well. Now, you might say, well, when the non-interventionists said, we don't think the Russians are a threat, does this show they're kind of blind to the communist threat? Wasn't there this big threat from communism? And the non-interventionists did think there was a threat from communism. They weren't people who said, well, we don't really have to worry about the communists because the communists are just nice people. They're just a little more left-wing than some of the American Democrats. They're nothing to worry about. On the contrary, they were, just like Flynn, they're extremely anti-communist. But they thought, and I think they were right on this, that the main communist threat was internal, not external. What do I mean by this? They thought the threat wasn't that the communists were going to mass armies, Russian armies, and come in and invade us. More the threat was that there'd be the Communist Party and its various organizations would try to subvert American policy. And what had happened in World War II, the Communist Party and its many sympathizers had a great deal of influence. It sounds odd today, now that we know what a terrible tyranny Stalin was, it sounds odd to think that there were people who approved of Stalin, but he was very popular in many circles in American World War II. There were people who thought very highly of him, a lot of communists in their sympathizers in high places. For example, Harry Dexter White, who was in charge of international affairs for the Treasury Department, he was also the chief aide to the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr., was a communist spy. There's some people who don't think he was, but most evidence shows he was. He passed the material to the communists and he advised on policy in a way that would support the Russian interest. So there were communists in very high places in the American government. I'm sure many of you have heard of the famous Alger Hiss case. Hiss was a Communist Party spy who had a high position in the American State Department. There were quite a number of others. So this wasn't all made up. You know, some people say, oh, well, there was this terrible McCarthy period when we were all under this tyranny where people fought the communists under the bed. There really were a lot of communists who were very influential. Now, so that's this first approach that is non-interventionism. Now, the approach that actually prevailed was called containment. And this approach held that the verdict in Eastern and Central Europe couldn't be reversed in the immediate future. They can say, well, we don't like, say, the fact that the Russians put a satellite government in Poland, or they established in Czechoslovakia in 1948, another communist government. We don't like this, but what can we really do about it? We can't very well go in and not as much. We fought World War II as allies with the Russians. We can't very go in and tell them, you've got to get out or we're going to come in and attack you. So we can't really do anything about where they are now. But what we should do is stop the Soviets from advancing any further. We should say there's very influential communist parties, say, in France and Italy. So we should prevent the Soviets from trying to establish communist governments in those countries. We say, you've gone so far, but you're not going any further. That's it. The supporters of this view included George Kennan, who lived to be 101 years old, who was the one who formulated the policy. He'd been American ambassador to Moscow, and he sent a famous telegram to the State Department called a long telegram, where he gave the basics of the containment policy. And he also wrote a famous article in Foreign Affairs, which was under the pseudonym X, where he was describing Russian foreign policy, that the Russians was dominated by communist ideology, but we can withstand this by containing them. And another key supporter of containment was Dean Acheson, who became Secretary of State under Truman. Dean Acheson was another very interesting figure. He had very high office in the Treasury under Franklin Roosevelt, but when Roosevelt ordered the confiscation of gold held by Americans, he thought that was really a terrible thing to do. He'd been a Wall Street lawyer, and he resigned from his position in the government. He came back. He was Under Secretary of State and Secretary of State under Truman. So he was a very big supporter of containment, and he tended to view containment as more of a military measures than Kennan did. Kennan thought, well, we've got to contain the Soviets, but he didn't think of it as strongly military way as Acheson did. So we can see the containment policy at work in a famous speech Truman gave in March 1947, where he called for aid to Greece and Turkey. He said these countries are in danger of going communist, so we've got to give them aid to prevent them. And in the Truman Doctrine, in this speech, he said, we're going to give aid to any democratic country that we think is in danger of succumbing to communism. So we're going to help all these countries and prevent the communists from taking them over. And Dean Acheson admitted that in trying to get congressional support for aid to Greece and Turkey, that they had to use scare tactics. They were saying, well, the communists are really threatening to take over. We've got to stop them. There's an immediate menace to this country. It was kind of scare tactics to justify the policy they wanted. Now, I see your question, why were the U.S. elite so concerned about containment coming? Well, I mean, they thought that, one thing what they thought, that if the communists took over in more countries, this could be a threat to American business interests. This would be one of the things. And then they actually thought that there was a danger that communists were trying to take over the world. The similar mentality to what had gotten us into World War II. And we thought there was a feeling that Germans would get too powerful and this would be a threat to us. So now people were thinking, if the Russians get too strong, this would be a big threat to us, so we've got to do something about it. Now, also connected with, along with the aid to Greece and Turkey, the Truman Doctrine, was the Marshall Plan. This was giving aid to countries in Western Europe from 1948 to 1952. It's another example of containment. And this wasn't, when we talk about Marshall Plan 8, it wasn't an example of, and just saying, well, we're going to be very unselfish, we're helping all these countries, just so we're going to give them all this money. It would also help various American businesses because, say, when the country would get Marshall Plan 8, they would be very often required to buy from American firms that would be helping those American firms. Now, Henry Hazlitt said, well, you know, this isn't going to help America very much because say, if you give a country money and say, okay, you can buy American goods, but we're giving you the money, you're really giving away the goods. But of course, it did help, it doesn't help Americans as a whole, but it does help those particular businesses. Now, when I said there's a difference between Kennan and Ashley, Kennan was less military. One thing Kennan thought was, well, if we can just hold out for a while against the communists, if we can stop them from expanding any further, then eventually the communist states would collapse internally. Well, this is interesting, I think it's kind of a parallel with Mises' famous calculation argument against socialism. Mises is saying, well, ultimately, the socialist government can't sustain itself because it can't perform economic calculation. So Kennan didn't make any reference to Mises, but it's kind of a similar parallel argument. He's saying, look, communist system won't work, so if we just hold out about against them for a while, they're going to collapse internally. Of course, he was right, they did. He lived to see this because his state lived to be 101. Now, there was a third option, which was we shouldn't be satisfied with preventing the Russians from going any further. We should end their conquest, if necessary, by preventing war. So the view was, well, we've got, at least, this is until 1949, America had a monopoly of atomic weapons, so why don't we, tell the Russians, if you better get out, if you don't, look what you saw what we did to the Japanese, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you'll get the same treatment, so you better get out. So this view had some support in the military, but it didn't win out. However, it did come to influence American conservatives. Remember, I said the old right was non-interventionist, but after, particularly in the 1950s, the National Review magazine was started, I think, around 1954-55, under William Buckley, and they supported this rollback view, so it replaced the old right. So among the American right wing, this rollback or preventive war view became very influential. It's that containment doesn't go far enough, we really got to go in and roll back the Russians. Now, so far we've been talking about Europe, but remember World War II was fought in Asia as well. Remember, the Japanese had been moving into China in the 1930s, and the struggle in China between Japan and China continued throughout the World War II. And there were two Chinese groups fighting against the Japanese, and they're also fighting each other. So you had a three-cornered struggle going on in China during World War II. There was a nationalist government, which was headed by Chiang Kai-shek, and the communists were led by Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. This is the kind of an older English spelling. I think they spell it with a Z now, but I'm used to this spelling, so that's why I put it that way. But we had the communists, and were fighting the Japanese and also fighting the nationalists, and the nationalists were fighting the communists and the Japanese. It was kind of a very confusing situation. I see somebody's made a reference to George Nash. Oh, yes, he's a very nice person. I know him. Yes, very good, good, nice fellow. I've met him a couple times. So Russia did not get involved in the war against Japan until August 1945. Russia just got in the last few days of the war. But the Russians were giving help to the Chinese communists. Now, the Chinese communists had many supporters in the U.S., including some in the U.S. government, like Harry Dexter White, who I've mentioned before, and Owen Lattimore, who'd been an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, was actually pretty sympathetic to the communists. So the communist propaganda portrayed these Chinese communists as really agrarian reformers. They said, well, these are really nice people. They just want to break up the dominance of these landlords who were oppressing the peasants. They're really good people. We should support them. And of course, they were very strong communists, but the pro-communist groups in America really conducted a big propaganda campaign on their behalf. Now, besides the pro-communists, such as Owen Lattimore, whom I've just mentioned, there were many people in the government who had a poor opinion of Chiang Kai-shek. They thought he wasn't really very effective in either governing or fighting the Japanese, so they didn't really want to support him. And the Secretary of State, George Marshall, who was a famous general in World War II, was the one who was really in charge of the war effort. He wanted Chiang Kai-shek to form a coalition with the communists, and they pressured Chiang Kai-shek to do this, even though the communists really weren't interested in the coalition. They really wanted to take over the government, but George Marshall was urging Chiang Kai-shek to try to form a coalition with them. So in 1949, China fell to the communists. And Chiang Kai-shek fled to the island of Formosa, where he established a government in exile. So after this happened, Marshall and Acheson, who was the Undersecretary of State, came under a great deal of criticism for their policies in China. People were saying to them, look, it's because you didn't give enough help to Chiang Kai-shek, and you were trying to get this coalition of the communists, because of you that we lost China, as they put it. Now, some people said, well, you know, China isn't ours to lose, but that wasn't what the critics said. They said, you lost China. And the famous Senator Joseph McCarthy was one of those who attacked Marshall and Acheson. In fact, McCarthy wrote a book attacking Marshall where he more or less suggested that Marshall was pro-communist. The so-called China Lobby, which was a group of pro-nationalist writers and publicists such as Alfred Kolber, were very critical of Marshall and Dean Acheson. So this made Acheson very sensitive, because he'd been criticized so much, to further communist advances. And unlike Kennan, who thought didn't think Asia was very important for U.S. security, Acheson applied containment to Asia as well as Europe. So he didn't favor overthrowing the Chinese communists. He thought he didn't like Chiang Kai-shek anyway, but he thought that we didn't want communism to advance anymore in Asia. So he said, well, all right, the communists have taken over China. Chiang Kai-shek was weak. We couldn't really do anything about it. But we're not going to allow the communists to take over anything else if we can stop them. And also, Acheson thought that American interests in Asia required a strong Japanese economy. So we have, according to him, we have to rebuild Japan. You know, we just defeated Japan. We should promote Japanese recovery, and this would also help American business. So when Japan surrendered in 1945, the U.S. Army occupied the southern part of Korea from 1945 through 1948. A lot of people don't realize that Korea was for several years under American occupation. Now, this demarcation line, which is the famous 38th parallel, was arbitrary. It was just something that was made by an official in the State Department, Dean Rusk, who later became Secretary of State under President Kennedy. So this is just a line that this official in the State Department drawn is at the 38th parallel, and this is make South Korea. But there wasn't, historically, there weren't two Korean nations, South and North Korea. Korea had been an independent kingdom for over 1,000 years, and the Japanese had taken over as a protectorate around 1904, 1905, and then they annexed it in 1910. So in this period, this is the central background you have to get to understand Korean War. In the period after the Japanese took it over in 1945 and the Japanese were defeated, there was a division in Korean society between those who favored collaboration with the Japanese, said, well, the Japanese have come in, they're very strong, we can't really get rid of them, so why don't we try to go along with them? And there were others who said, no, we've got to preserve, try to regain independence for Korea, and resisted the Japanese. So this is a basic division in Korean society. Now, while the Americans were occupying South Korea, the Russians and Chinese communists supported a communist regime in North Korea. And this was, this communist regime was headed by Kim Il-sung, who had been a leader in the anti-Japanese resistance. So one of the things the North Koreans said, well, said the South Koreans had a lot of former Japanese collaborators in their government, but our group were the ones who were really resisting the Japanese. Now, when the American occupation ended in 1948, there was a new government was put in under American sponsorship. It was headed by Syngman Rhee, who was a very strongly anti-communist leader. He had not been a Japanese collaborator, been out of Korea for a long time, but he came back and he was a very authoritarian figure, so he headed the new government. Now, both of these, both the Syngman Rhee regime in the South and the North Korean, Kim Il-sung, both said that each one claimed to be the legitimate government under of all of Korea. So we don't have a situation, say, where the say the South Koreans say, well, we're the government here in South Korea. We don't care what happens in North Korea. You know, that's an independent country. Both sides were saying, we're the only legitimate government of all of Korea. And as you can imagine, the two conflicting governments didn't get along very well. And there were several border incursions on both sides. But in June 1950, the South Koreans attacked. They had a quite massive invasion of the North Koreans attacked. They had a massive invasion of South Korea. And it appears from documents that have come out later that Kim Il-sung had cleared this with Stalin, told Stalin, we're going to attack, and Stalin said, okay, go ahead and do that. So Stalin knew this was coming. Now, when this happened, Dean Acheson, who was the Secretary of State, decided on his own initiative that America would intervene, would bring in troops and try to push the North Koreans out. But when he did it, it wasn't clear why America had any security interest in Korea. I mean, we could say, well, we wouldn't be very happy if Korea became communist, but why does it matter? It's not a threat to us. Korea is a relatively small country. Why should we care if it did become communist? Why should we try to stop the communists from taking over there? Now, Acheson, of course, cleared his decision with President Truman, but there was no attempt by Truman to secure a declaration of war from Congress. And remember, in the Constitution, the power to declare war is clearly given to Congress. And in all the major wars that the U.S. had been engaged in, there had always been a declaration of war from Congress. Even Roosevelt, who was not the person given to constitutional niceties very much, went to Congress and asked for declaration of war. He didn't say, okay, the Japanese attack, so I'm going to order on my own initiative a response. He asked for declaration of war. Woodrow Wilson had done that also. But instead of doing that, Truman just got a mandate from the UN, the United Nations. So really, American sovereignty was completely subordinate to this international body. And this was unconstitutional. It was a very dangerous departure from American tradition, because they say, well, we don't have to follow what the Constitution says. We can just, the president will decide under the behest of this international body to get us involved in war. I see the question, why didn't Congress become outraged actually in June over this? Well, I remember that a lot of the work, some people such as Robert Taft weren't happy about it, but Truman had a lot of supporters in Congress, and a lot of people thought we did need to fight the Korean communists. So it's not clear that had he gone to Congress that he couldn't have gotten the declaration of war that he wanted, but he just didn't favor it. He didn't want, he deliberately didn't do that. He wanted to show that he wasn't bound by the traditional way of looking at the Constitution. So after the North Koreans had come in and pushed the South Koreans out, they'd taken over Seoul, which is the capital, but the South Koreans then rallied with the famous Incheon landing under the leadership of Douglas MacArthur. This is Incheon, is a port near Seoul. It's kind of he just came in and behind the Korean army and attacked them, so it enabled them to regain control of the capital. Now, if you read in some sources that this is kind of a big surprise, but really, the North Koreans had thought that that might be happening. They just didn't have the force to stop it. So then, after this very successful landing, General MacArthur, who was one of the greatest of all American generals, pressed north. And in doing that, in pressing to the north, he had the full approval of Secretary of State Acheson, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So sometimes you think, well, MacArthur was this really warmonger figure who had these unrestrained goals, and the State Department's more moderate, but MacArthur had the full approval of Acheson, Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when MacArthur crossed the 38th parallel, remember this demarcation line that Steve Ruskin put in, Acheson said, well, this is all right because this is just an imaginary line. But the problem there was, when he said that, it really destroying the base for U.S. intervention, because remember what Acheson had said was, well, we're coming to the aid of South Korea because this other nation, North Korea, has attacked South Korea. But if you say the 38th parallel is just imaginary line, then this is in effect admitting that the war in Korea was just a civil war among competing groups who were claiming to be the Korean government, and intervening in a civil war would have much less justification. We couldn't say, well, we're supporting this principle of resisting aggression where one nation tries to take over another, because a civil war is just different groups are claiming to be a national government. So when Acheson said that, he really destroyed the basis of American intervention. So after MacArthur pushed to the Chinese border, the Chinese entered in force and then pushed the American forces back, and there was eventually the sides would just fight each other. There was an eventual stalemate, which was somewhere around this 38th parallel. Now, during the war, Truman contemplated using atomic weapons. He didn't do that, but he thought about it. Joint Chiefs of Staff did. And again, sometimes people think there was this big divergence between MacArthur and the administration, but there wasn't. MacArthur was removed by Truman for insubordination, but basically what the reason was that he was removed was that Truman and Acheson didn't trust him. They thought he was kind of someone who would just go off by himself and didn't want to obey orders. But there wasn't a basic difference in policy between them. So he had this fighting over these years from 1950-1953. Many, it had been large numbers of Americans and Koreans killed, and we really just reestablished the situation that existed when the war started. So it really didn't achieve very much, even on its own terms. So I think that will end the lecture now, and we can now go to this Q&A box. So if you have questions or comments, objections, please put them in the Q&A. And I'll try to answer them if I can. Okay, I'm going to press on the Q&A now. Silly question. What do you think would have happened if Germany won World War II? Well, that's very hard to say. I think there would just, it might not have been all that different from what happened with the Russians, I think Germany would have had a terrific time, very difficult time sustaining itself over a long period, and maybe we would have had some kind of evolution of that government. You know, it's very hard to answer that. Justin said, isn't one of the ways FDR tried to endear himself to Stalin is by mocking Churchill at a summit? Yes, I think he did do that. I'm trying to forget which one it was, but he did do that. You're quite right. Now, Ivan said, Anthony Sutton claims U.S. government and many U.S. corporations continually transfer huge amounts of technology and equipment to the USSR from 1917 on, thus building the infrastructure there. Are you familiar with what you think of it? Well, see, Sutton wrote a three-volume book, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, which was published by the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto. And what I think he does show that there was a tremendous amount of aid by U.S. corporations to the Russians. I think he does establish his thesis. Now, some of his later stuff I don't think as highly of. I think he has one called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. He has something on the rise of Hitler, too. He's always blaming U.S. corporations. But I think what he did in this earlier study is seems like it holds up. He may have had some help on that because it's much more scholarly than some of these later books. He later went in for unusual conspiracy theories, such as blaming the, he thought the American government was dominated by this people who had been in the this Yale club called like Skull and Bones or something like that. So he went in for unusual conspiracy theories. I never met him. I've known people who knew him and actually gave him money. But I think the earlier book is, the series that you refer to is a pretty good, well-established book. It's definitely a good thing. Yes, Kathy says it wasn't only well shipments of wheat. Yes, that's a good point. I mean, we sent them. See, now the shipments, there were a lot of shipments in the Hoover relief mission right after World War in the 1920s under Herbert Hoover, there was a lot of food relief sent to Russia when they're having a famine. There was this, you're quite right, there was a famine relief sent to Russia. Tony, were the post-war American communists really espousing communist ideals? were they fully aware of the totalitarian aspects of Stalin? Well, basically, what the American communists said was really that all they were aware that people had had these charges against them and said, well, this just isn't true. You know, they have all these stories about the communist camps and killing all these people, but these are just exaggerations of anti-communists. We shouldn't believe these. Stalin is really a wonderful person. He's really bringing Russia, he's developing Russia, he's a great democratic leader. So I think they tended to dismiss the totalitarian aspects. They said, Stalin is not the same sort of person as Hitler was. He's a much better person. Maybe he doesn't do everything the way we would in America, but he's really an all-around good guy. Jeff said, did Churchill have any political goals motivating his iron curtain speech, or was it motivated by his own personal ideology? That's an excellent question. Well, I think what Churchill was trying to do in his famous speech, Westminster College, he says, from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind it lie all the ancient capitals of Europe. You can watch this on YouTube. We have Churchill, one of the great orators, has a very distinctive way of speaking. So what I think he was doing, see, the Americans after World War II, maybe this is something that's become into more intellectual, we were in a position to dominate, to balance between the Russians and the British. We could say, well, we have the British Empire on one side and the Russians on the other hand, so we would be in a position to balance between them. But the British didn't like that because they were had the traditional they were the traditional people who wanted to hold the balance of power. They would say, well, we want to be the one in control of the balance of power. So what Churchill was trying to do was really to get the Americans to come out more against the communists and really take over the role, the principal British role opposing them, because a lot of the Soviet propaganda was really, after the war, was really directed against the British as their main opponents. So the Churchill said, well, we want to get Stalin really attacking against the Americans primarily, and then we can act as kind of a third party basically supporting the American, that Stalin won't be attacking us directly so much. So I was really trying to get the Americans more involved, I think. Now, one from Brian here, if Eisenhower would have been president at the start of the Korean War, do you think the U.S. would have intervened? Well, that's difficult to say. I mean, Eisenhower came in saying we'll end the war in Korea, and he did, but I think Eisenhower was pretty much in agreement with the other military figures of his time. So I don't think there was any basic divergence in policy between Eisenhower and Truman. It's possible, I suppose, they wouldn't have, but it's hard to say. Now the question here, what is your opinion of the reliability of the known cable? Well, that's not a question I've gone into. Much myself, but I think they're generally accepted as authentic. I mean, I don't think they've been challenged. Leslie says, is there a consensus now among historians that Hitler was guilty of spying for the Russians, but if you're trying to get it right, or do many historians still think Hitler was innocent? No, I think most people do think he was guilty. The Venona cable seemed to identify him as a communist agent. There's a book published by Alan Weinstein, I think it was quite influential. There are people who criticize him, but I think Hiss does seem to have been guilty. I remember there were all sorts of funny conspiracy theories, like the FBI had faked the typewriter, that these documents were allegedly written on, that Hiss had typed copies of documents that he gave to the Russians that Chambers discovered in the famous pumpkin papers and stuff. There was a book, I think, published by Fred Cook, who was a journalist who wrote for Nation magazine, claiming the FBI had committed forgery by typewriter. There was, I think, one of his hired someone named Lane, not Mark Lane, one of Kennedy's assassins, some other man named Lane, who had claimed that, but I don't think those claims were ever sustained. Now, Tony said, oil fields were fought heavily for during World War II. I'm not sure the Cold War companies resource-based versus ideological. But I think there were certainly there were American business interests who were wanting to take over and gain control of various resources, but it was also ideological as well. So I think both were involved. I think it would be a mistake to say it's a purely economic conflict. There is a school of historians, I think Walter Lefebvre at Cornell, and there's a very interesting man, Christopher Lane, who does think that American business interests trying to achieve dominance was kind of a big thing in the Cold War. Noam Chomsky has held that view also. So I think that's important. I don't think it's the only or even the dominant factor, but it is an important thing. Brian says, what are libertarians' general view of McCarthyism? Well, I don't think there's any kind of a general particular view among libertarians. Murray Rothbard, interesting, was quite sympathetic to McCarthy. Because he was involved in some Youth for McCarthy organization. He rather thought his view was that McCarthy had really come up with there was quite a bit of evidence that there were communists sympathizing with the State Department and elsewhere. And there wasn't that some people said, well, there's this general attack on people's liberties. But remember, people don't have a right to a government job. So Murray Rothbard was pretty sympathetic to McCarthy, although there are some memos where he's a bit more critical of him. But there are others where he seems pretty favorable to him. Now, I don't know what other libertarians have written on that topic, but that was Rothbard's view. Justin, do you think Joseph McCarthy was the mass manipulator most people view him nowadays? No, that's an excellent question. No, he was simply one of a number of people who were interested in investigating communism. There were others such as Pat McCarran, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, William Jenner. There are various people. I mean, also there are people in the American government, and not Truman. Truman was interested in investigating communism. So I think what a lot of people do who don't like these investigations of communism, they say since McCarthy was a very unpopular figure, at least they just try to say, well, when you're investigating communism, it's all McCarthyism. But it wasn't the case. He was just one of a number of people who was, I think, in the subcommittee on government operations of the Senate. Now, Peter said, did McCarthy ever investigate or blacklist private citizens or just government officials? I think it was primarily government officials. I think there were private citizens who were called to testify by him and some of the other committees. I mean, they were investigations not by him, but of communist infiltration of Hollywood by the House Committee on American Activities. There were other things, but it was more government officials. He was famous. I have here in my hand a list of communists in the State Department. Now, there's some controversy as to what he said, how many he said. I think the best evidence was 57, or somebody said, no, he said 205, but there is he was mainly government official. Now, Leslie said, I think libertarian historian James J. Martin has written a lot on pro-communist sympathize in the leading government in after World War II. Yes, well, he has a two-volume book, Liberalism and World Politics, sort of in the more in the 1930s. I think he does have some essays on this. John T. Flynn also wrote on this at one called The Lattimore Case, dealing with Owen Lattimore. One very interesting pamphlet on this by the revisionist historian Harry Elmer Barnes, remember I mentioned him in my World War One lecture. He had a pamphlet, very interesting, called The Chickens of the Liberal Interventionists Have Come Home to Roost. So what he pointed out was that a lot of the left-wing people were saying, oh, look how terrible McCarthy is, and all these people investigating communists, they're suppressing civil liberties. He pointed out that these same left-wingers were the ones who said in 1930, we've got to go after all these groups that are opposing entry into World War II. These are all fascists and Nazis. We've got to investigate them. So they were really getting what in after the war, they were getting what they had wanted to dish out before. A lot of the communist groups were saying, we've got to suppress the right-wing and fascist groups, and some of the same tactics were being applied to them. Jim Martin is an interesting person. I met him just once in June 1979. I met him just once. Just a sec here. Jesse says, you didn't claim that Reagan was responsible for ending communism. Had any truth to it? Well, that's an interesting question. I'm inclined to think that the general difficulties of the communist system would have brought an end to it anyway. I mean, Reagan, I doubt he really did that much. I mean, in fact, I think had the U.S. followed non-interventionist policy after the war, then I think possibly the communism could have ended much sooner because the communists wouldn't have seen there was less, they wouldn't have thought there was kind of a military threat to them, so there would have been less pressure to build up this communist military. But of course, that's very speculative. So I think the main reason communism came to an end is just the internal weakness of the communist systems. And that would just, again, that's more speculative, but I'd be inclined to think that. Tony says, can you recommend any good entry-level books on the economic aspects that lead to American wars? You might look, I think there's one, you might start with, I think Murray Rothbard has some stuff on that, you should look, I think there's some books, there's some pamphlets by Rothbard you should look at, and then William Appleman Williams is another author who has a lot on this. You can just get the titles just by looking up the names, Murray Rothbard, William Appleman Williams, and then you'll see the books that they've written on this. Brian says, what do you think is the most destructive time period in American history with respect to liberty? Well, I would think it's really the period, the World War One through World War Two, really. I think we probably had the most civil liberties violations. We're having a lot of violations right now, unfortunately. I think certainly in World War One, World War Two, there were all sorts of violations of liberty. Remember, World War Two, the Japanese were locked up from lived on the West Coast, and there were also restrictions on certain German Italian residents. So this was people were put on trial for sedition in World War II. And Roosevelt was always in World War II, he was trying to have the IRS investigate people who criticized him and try to suppress them. So I think that was certainly a very bad time for civil liberties. Peter said, what happened to the old right after World War II? Seems like they got taken over by the neocons. Well, there were a few figures left from the old right, like John T. Flynn and Garrett Garrett. And Harry Elmer Barnes had really not been conservative, but there were sort of non-interventionists. But a lot of the, there were some people who've been non-interventionists in World War II who thought, well, communism is so dangerous, we've got to really join in the Cold War against them. I've known people like them. So this, the old right became somewhat unfashionable. There were, Murray Rothbard, of course, was a strong supporter of that type of foreign policy, but they lost a lot of influence. Tim says, well, there was public outrage from American citizens against Ashton Truman in the early 50s. Yet, see, Truman, when he was left office, had, I think, the lowest rating, approval rating of any American president, at least up to that time, about 25%. So, you know, he could have run for office again. Remember, you know, the president can only run for 2 terms, but he had only been elected president once. You know, he was the winner in the 1948 election, and he'd taken over from Roosevelt. When Roosevelt died, he was the vice president, so he would have probably, I think, been eligible to run again, but he decided not to because he was so unpopular. And the reason there was great criticism of Ashton Truman was Truman had a lot of controls on the American economy that were unpopular. And the Korean War was very unpopular, and also they were, Acheson was very much criticized for his loss of China. Brian says, would you consider Eisenhower a neocon? No, I don't think. Remember, he warned against the military-industrial complex, and I don't think he had kind of a general neocon mindset. Now, Kathy, did I hear you say MacArthur was the greatest general? Why do you say that? Well, I didn't say that. I just said he was one of the great generals. I didn't say the greatest. I think the reason I said that he's one of the greatest generals, I think that's the way he's usually viewed. He was considered one of the top military minds of his time. There are people who criticize him, but do you think that when you ask it, do you think that view is incorrect? I mean, I was just giving everybody that, that's just it. He certainly made mistakes. For example, when the Philippines were attacked by the Japanese in December 1941, he wasn't very well prepared, but he was very successful in many other things. He's certainly the greatest speaker of the generals in World War II. You can watch his farewell address, the famous farewell address to Congress. I think in Sin's book, we took money from Japan and the Philippines. Well, I mean, if you want to, he may have done that, but I mean, a lot of great generals have been interested in private profit. I mean, Julius Caesar was somebody who profited from war, from the Roman Wars, but I mean, he's one of the greatest generals of all time. So, I mean, when you assess somebody's a great general, it's usually on their military achievements. And there are people who don't rate MacArthur that highly. I think Max Hastings, in his book, just came out, doesn't think he was, he thought he made a lot of mistakes, but I think he is generally rated pretty highly as a general. I mean, I'm not a military historian, so I could well be wrong about that. But I mean, I do think if you listen to his, if you have a chance, you listen on YouTube, his farewell address to Congress, and you also want to hear Roosevelt's speech calling for the declaration of war against Japan, you'll see what really great speaking is like. Mark said, do you think Marsh was overrated? Well, I think he was a very able military leader. He was he's very well thought of in World War II, but he made a lot of mistakes in handling China. I think some of the criticism is well taken. Peter says, do you think Marsh were planning successor when he'd gone down a black hole? Well, I'm inclined to more the latter view, that it was just giving away money. It's sort of trying to, it wasn't. Henry Hazlitt has some good stuff on that world dollar state, the world kind of critical of the Marshall Plan. So I really don't think it was that major factor in Europe's recovery. The main thing was when the West Germany decided to move toward a freer economy under Ludwig Erhard rather than retaining the controls of the American advisors were favored. I think William Manchester wrote in Japan when MacArthur's name was being batted around, some demonstrated health sign, we pray for MacArthur's election, except they missed it with T and R in election. Well, that's a very good story, so I think we'll probably end on that one. Mark just said, oh, one other, didn't Marshall also advise Truman to stay out of setting up the state of Israel? Yes, he did that. He thought that would be a big mistake. So did the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal. That's right. I think did hold that view. Quite right. Well, all right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming to my lecture. Hope now next week is the... next week we have to talk about Vietnam. I remember that one very well. Okay, so thanks everybody. See you all next week.